We're in a series about God, learning what God is like. That's the title of our series, and in that we're looking at characters in the Old Testament and lessons they learned about God, attributes of God that they learned in the course of their life and God's working with them. The attribute of God that we're going to focus on this evening is God's sovereignty. God's sovereignty. Let me introduce it this way. One of my favorite chapters in the whole Bible, as you well know, is Isaiah chapter 40. There are at least two reasons why that is true. First of all, the wonderful, incomparable Isaiah imagery. God holding the waters of the oceans in his palm, measuring the immeasurable universe with the span of his hand. That's just imagery without rival. I also love Isaiah 40 for a second reason. It shows us that theology matters. In an age when theology is too often the doormat on which Christians wipe their feet of haughty ignorance, Isaiah 40 teaches us a very profound lesson. Theology matters. It's practical. What you think about God, in fact, changes how you live. You remember that Isaiah wrote to a worried, fearful, lonely, abandoned people who were crushed by circumstances, tempted by the world, and he taught them a theology. He taught them who their God was, and you better believe it changed how they lived. Isaiah understood what the anti-theology crowd fails to realize. You live out what you believe about God. You live out what you believe. If you believe in a weak, faltering, insubstantial God, then in fact you will have a weak, faltering, insubstantial faith. Circumstances and trials, they'll disrupt you, they'll depress you, they'll devastate you. Well, in this series, What is God Like?, we're studying God, and we're doing so not just for information, not just for theology, not just for data, but so that we can live better. So that we can live better to His glory, for the world's instruction, and in the end, for our own stability as well. Now, one of the most important attributes of God when it comes to His glory and our stability is God's sovereignty. God's sovereignty. And that's what we want to consider tonight. Let me introduce you to this theology matters kind of study of God's sovereignty. Let me introduce you to this attribute, and then we'll consider it as marvelously evidenced in the life of an Old Testament character. There are a lot of definitions, complicated definitions of God's sovereignty. I could have read to you any number of them tonight. In the end, they all mean this: God can do anything He wants. That's what God's sovereignty means. God can do anything that He wants. My favorite verse about God's sovereignty are found in the Psalms. Turn to Psalm 115, verse 3. Now, in that definition, God can do anything He wants to. Well, it's important to understand that God doesn't want to do evil and things like that, right? But God can do anything He wants, and this is perhaps the best verse in the whole Bible to point that out. Psalm 115, verse 3. But our God is in the heavens, and He does whatever He pleases. That is just an unapologetic declaration of the brute sovereignty of God. The God of Israel, the God of the Bible, is set apart from all other claimants to the title God by many things, but perhaps most evident of all is His sovereignty. He does whatever He wants to. Psalm 103 states in a little bit more cultured terms. Psalm 103, verse 19 specifically. It says, "The Lord has established His throne in the heavens. His sovereignty, His dominion rules over all." God can do anything He wants to. This verse also points something else. Not only can He do anything He wants to, He can also tell everyone else to do whatever He wants them to do. It's not just that He can do it, but He can tell everyone else what to do too. That's sovereignty. Ephesians 1 verse 11 says that God works all things after the counsel of His will. He doesn't need advice, He does what He wants to. Philippians 2 verse 13 says that God is at work in you both to will and to work His good pleasure. He does what He wants, but more than that, He can make you do what He wants. That's sovereignty. Now, let me take this a step further. Walking hand in hand with God's sovereignty is something else: God's providence. It's not so much an attribute of God, it's really the outworking of sovereignty. Providence is this. God's work to sustain and direct all the affairs of creation. It's God working day in, day out, minute in, minute out, second in and second out to maintain, establish, and run the universe. It is providence, His sovereignty in action. Sovereignty is God's ability to do what He wants. Providence is what it looks like when He does. Burkhoff, a great theologian, said this about providence. He says it is God's work, quote, whereby the Creator preserves all of His creatures, is operative in all that comes to pass in the world, and directs all things to their appointed end. Now, God's sovereignty working out in providence, the order and the arranging of all the events in our lives and the world, it's obvious all over the Scripture. Colossians 1 verse 16, for example, says that Christ created all things. And then verse 17 adds, in Him all things hold together. The world runs because God guides and directs it moment by moment. This, by the way, is the basis of all scientific inquiry. The predictable patterns that we somewhat mistakenly call the laws of nature are more accurately described as God's providence. His instant by instant intervention to make things happen in the natural physical realm the same way every time. Because if He didn't guide and direct that and intervene every time, it wouldn't. Galileo dropped two balls of different weight off the top of a tower in the 1600s. They both hit the ground at the same time. You know what? If you do that today, 400 years later, the same thing will happen. Not because of a law, but because God works in the same predictable way, maintaining and sustaining His creation. That's God's providence. It happens the same way every single time, except when He does a miracle, which is God working in a way that He doesn't normally work. So scientific observation and the reproduction of experiments, they're all possible only because God sovereignly, providentially, moment by moment, sustains the creation in the same way every day. Now, God's providence doesn't only affect the physical creation, though. It obviously also works into the lives of men. First, on the macro level, God is in control of the affairs of nations. He guides and directs them, plans them, and orders them. Acts 17, verse 26 says, God made from one man, Adam, every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. God can do what He wants, and He can make you do what He wants too. God controls the affairs not only of nations, but of the kings of nations as well. In Daniel chapter 4, verse 34 and 35, King Nebuchadnezzar stopped grazing, and he looks up at heaven and he says, God's dominion is an everlasting dominion. He does according to His will. And He does that in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can ward off His hand. God does what He wants, and He can make you do what He wants to. Now, that's normally how we think of God's sovereignty. Kind of on that macro level. God runs the universe. He directs everything. He's bringing it all together. We don't always quite bring it down, though, to where it would impact our lives personally. And that's what we need to think about this evening. God's intervention to organize and direct His creation extends right through the physical universe, nations, kings, and all of that, right down to you and me. Look at Psalm 139 for a moment. Psalm 139. I promised you a story tonight. Don't worry, we'll get there. Psalm 139. God's sovereignty works all the way down into the lives of insignificant people like you and me. Verse 13 of Psalm 139. You formed my inward parts, God, says David. You wove me together in my mother's womb. I'll give thanks to You, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are Your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from You when I was made in secret, skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. That was a poetic way of describing the womb. Your eyes, notice this, Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in Your book were written all the days that were ordained for me. All the ordained days, they were all written down when there was not yet one of them. God made you, says David, and you know what? He lays out your life for you too. He is sovereign. He can do what He wants, and He makes us do what He wants too. Proverbs 20, verse 24 says it this way, a man's steps are ordained by the Lord's. God's not responsible for our sin. We understand that. We're not going to get into that tonight. And yet God somehow is sovereign over all of life, not only over the physical creation, but in fact over our day-by-day, minute-by-minute life. This is not an impractical, abstract doctrine. The truth that God is sovereign and that His providence is working out His good plan, and you need to underline good, that's important. God's sovereignty is working out through His providence His good plan. He's doing that right now. To understand that is critical to a God-glorifying, stable daily life. And the reason is simple. Life is full of calamities. We're attacked by trials, natural disasters, health disruptions, financial collapses, family conflicts, aging, all the other unpredictable ups and downs of life. They're there all the time. And in the vicissitudes or changes of life, the only thing that can keep us stable is having our feet on the rock. The sovereign God who has the power to do what He wants and always works out His will. To live life to God's glory, to be joyful in trials, to be thankful in difficulty, to be content in blessing. For all of that, we must understand that God is sovereign and He works out in providence, arranging all the events of this world and our lives. He does that for good, for those who love Him. Romans 8:28. Right? Now, as we think about God's sovereignty in that sense, God working and ordering everything to bring it all together for good, there is one character in the Bible who perhaps more than any other reveals this truth about God. He is found in the book of Genesis, and His name is Joseph. And so let's turn to Genesis. We'll start in chapter 30. Let's turn to Genesis and see the sovereignty of God, this great attribute of God, worked out not in some profound universal cosmic way, but worked out in the life of one lonely Jewish boy named Joseph. Joseph's story is kind of the movie version of Romans 8:28. God works all things together for good for those who love Him. Joseph is that verse walking. He's that verse with legs. No one on the planet has ever gone through more neck-wrenching changes from heights to depths to heights again than Joseph did. His name maybe should have been Yo-Yo, not Joseph, because he's just up and down all the time. And in fact, that's going to be our outline this evening for our study of the life of Joseph, up and down. You'll be able to see it. Joseph's story is a great living picture of God's sovereignty at work, providentially behind the scenes in the details of an individual's life to turn bad into unexpected, unanticipated good. God working it all together for His perfect plan. Genesis 30. Here we see the birth of Joseph. Isaac, you remember, was Abraham's impossible miracle son. Isaac, in turn, had twins through his wife, Rebekah. The twins were Jacob and Esau. Jacob got an unexpected two-for-one deal from his father-in-law, Laban, when he got married. Two wives, Leah and Rachel. Rachel, you might remember from the biblical text, was barren for 20 years before God providentially intervened. And she fell pregnant with Joseph. Genesis 30, verse 22. Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her, and He opened her womb. So she conceived, and she bore a son, and said, God has taken away my reproach. She named him Joseph. May the Lord give me another son. She liked one so much, she wanted two. So she names her first child, give me another one. That's what Joseph's name means. This is really just one more example of God's promise in Genesis 12, verse 3. We looked at it in length last week with Abraham. It's one more example of that promise in action. God says, I will bless you. This is it. God will impossibly bless Abraham's descendants. And impossible births were one of God's favorite ways of doing that. Now, Rachel, you remember from the story, was the more loved wife, right? Leah, well, she was the one he didn't expect to get. And so Jacob kind of tolerated her. Rachel is the more loved wife. Naturally, the child of her old age became Jacob's most loved son. And this is really the first up of the life of Joseph. He's the special son, Right? Though it's kind of at the bottom of the pyramid, chronologically speaking, he's definitely at the top of the pyramid, love-wise. Though he is the 11th of 12 brothers, he is by far the favorite. Now, we meet Joseph next in the biblical account as a teenager, chapter 37. Chapter 37. Here we meet him again. He's growing up a bit. He's 17 years old. Verse 2, these are the records of the generations of Jacob. So, Jacob and his sons, primarily. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pastoring the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah and his father's wives. Joseph brought back bad reports about them to their father. Now Israel, another name for Jacob, Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons because he was the son of his old age. He made him a very colored tunic. Well, these verses tell us that, you know, Joseph, dad's favorite son, no doubt about that. He was a tattletale. It took to reporting on his adult brothers. They are, by the way, if he's 17, right, they're somewhere between 40 and 20. And so he's reporting on his adult brothers here. Jacob, it says, also gave him a special garment. The translations vary from multicolored to long-sleeved, and it's hard to say which is true. But he gave him some sort of special garment that marks Joseph's preeminent position in the family. Well, it's not hard to predict the result, is it? Verse 4. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him. They could not speak to him peacefully, in friendly terms. Now, you remember that Joseph didn't help matters a whole lot, boasting about some dreams that God had given him. Look at verse 5 of the same chapter. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. It's not helping. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream that I've had. For behold, we were binding sheaves." That's when they put all the stalks of grain together, tie them up in a bundle. It said, "We were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Joseph's brothers understood the imagery perfectly. Didn't need a whole lot of instruction. Verse 8, they said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us? You're the pup of the family. You know, you're the still wet behind the ears kid. You're a nobody. We're adult men. This is just nonsense, Joseph." And so they hated him even more for his dream and for his words. Well, with his father's love, Joseph is definitely preeminent in the family. And here, a divine assurance of family preeminence, he's definitely going to be at the top. They're all going to be bowing down to him. Well, with that kind of in hand, Joseph, no doubt, is thinking that his life is pretty much going to be if you drew it on a graph, the line's going to be going up, right? Just going to be the steady progress up. God, however, works his plan for our good and the good of others. He works that together in an intricate, unpredictable dance of sovereignty and providence. He can do what he wants, and sometimes he does what we don't expect. Chapter 37, verse 13. Israel, Jacob, says to Joseph one day, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send them to you." And he said, "Yeah, Dad, I'll go." Verse 18. And when they saw him from a distance, before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say that a wild beast devoured him." So they're going to murder and lie. "Then let us see what becomes of his dreams." They just don't think much of these dreams. God's not going to bring them about. We're going to kill him. Take him out of the picture. Reuben's the oldest son. He gets a little bit distressed about this. He rescued him out of their hands and said, "Well, let's not take his life. Right? Don't kill him." Reuben further said, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him." You see, Reuben wanted to rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. Verse 23, "So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and they threw him into the pit." The pit was empty, it didn't have any water in it. "Then they all sat down to eat a meal." They're obviously not too worked up about this, right? No conscience. As they raised their eyes and they looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, and their camels bearing aromatic gum, balm, myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it to us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? He said, what are we really getting out of this? I've got a better plan, guys. Come, verse 27, let us sell him to these Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. For, you know, he is our brother, he's our own flesh. So the brothers listened to him. We only saw him as a slave rather than kill him. Thanks, brothers. Then some Midianite traders passed by. They pulled him up out of the well. They lifted Joseph out of the pit. They sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. That's from the heights to the depths, my friend. Joseph's plan for uninterrupted success, for preeminence, is interrupted by this whiplash-causing change of direction. This is the first down of Joseph's life. He's at the bottom, literally, when he's down in the pit. And he's at the bottom figuratively, too, when he gets to Egypt. He's a foreign-born slave. He's an outsider. He's just a nobody. He's at the very bottom. He, the love-pampered son, protected from all emotional pain, no doubt shattered by the cruel betrayal of his brothers. But you know, God said in Genesis 12, verse 3, that controls all the rest of the text of Genesis. God said, I will bless you. And the golden rays of that promise bring light to even the darkest events in the lives of the patriarchs. Genesis 39. Joseph's at the bottom. It doesn't last long. Chapter 39, verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph. That's Genesis 12:3. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. I will bless you. So, Joseph found favor in the sight of his employer. He became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. You would be right in one sense to credit his extraordinary administrative ability to explain Joseph's climb from the bottom of the servant totem pole to the height of household manager. Joseph goes from the guy that carries out the little portable toilets and things like that, right, to now he's in charge of the whole house. From doing the worst job, from washing the feet of the slaves, or of everyone else, now he's at the height, household manager. You'd be right if you attributed that to Joseph's amazing administrative abilities. You would be more right to attribute it to Genesis 12:3. I will bless you. The whole rest of Genesis after that is how God takes care of the patriarchs in spite of their stupidness at times. God took Joseph down. Now he intervenes sovereignly, providentially, to bring him back up. All for his good, God's good, unexpected purposes. God is the one who gave Joseph these skills. He gets the credit for it. But Joseph, when he reaches the top of the ladder of Potiphar's house, God pushes the ladder over using the hand of Potiphar's bored, lustful wife. Verse 7 of chapter 39. It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. The end of verse 6 says, Joseph is handsome in form and appearance, kind of a hunk. And so the master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused. Said to his master's wife, behold, with me here my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he's put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? Of all the patriarchs, Joseph probably had the best understanding of God and marriage. Now, when I look at this, I don't know how many young single men in their early to middle 20s, where Joseph would have been here, who would have been, having been cut off from their family and having no accountability to anyone of true faith, I don't know a lot of guys that would have been able to withstand this kind of temptation. He's got no accountability, there's no one there, his family's in another land, they don't know where he's at, you know, he doesn't even know if God knows where he's at. But Joseph's understanding of God's holiness riveted him to the path of purity, and that path didn't go through this woman's bedroom. Well, you know what happened. Frustrated lust spawned evil bitterness in Potiphar's wife, and she framed Joseph for rape, and down went Joseph again, plunging this time to the literal depths of Pharaoh's dungeon. Verse 19. Now when his master heard the words of his wife, she's accused Joseph of raping him, of raping her. She spoke to him saying, "This is what your slave did to me." Then his anger burned, and so Joseph's master took him, put him into the jail. And he's going to believe Joseph or his wife? Well, he's got to go with his wife, right? And so he puts Joseph in jail in the place where the king's prisoners are confined, and he was there in jail. First, he's betrayed and sold as a slave by his brothers. Heart pain beyond imagination, right? Then he was falsely accused of a horrible crime and sent to fester in prison for something he didn't do. What good can God bring from this? Joseph couldn't have answered you. He would have had no answer at all. But you know, God is sovereign, and he providentially arranges the pieces on the chessboard. He takes the pieces and he puts them exactly where he wants them to be. Now, a novice chess player can't always discern the purpose and the strategy of the chess master, can he? He sees a move and he can't figure it out. Can't figure out why God has seemed to move you into check. God, are you trying to kill me here? I don't get it. God is sovereign. He takes the pieces and he puts them exactly where he wants. We can't always see the purpose, but there is a good purpose. Now, the end of chapter 39 records that God's promise to bless came shining through again. Joseph very quickly rose from rotting in the lowest dungeon to administrating the whole prison. He's just this kind of super competent guy. More importantly, verse 23 notes of chapter 39, the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper. God is providentially working to put Joseph in the position that he wants him to be. The position that God wanted Joseph to be in, however, was not the prison warden's administrative assistant. God doesn't want him there the rest of his life. That's not the good that God planned for Joseph. And so chapter 40 records Joseph's big break. Pharaoh's cupbearer, who was an important official, not just a waiter who brought the wine to the table or something like that. The cupbearer, important official, and then the baker, they're thrown into prison. God, it says in chapter 40, gave them both dreams of revelational significance. That's something that God did often in Genesis, but Hebrews 1 reminds us, just as an aside, that God speaking in many portions and many ways has now been replaced by his speaking in and through the Lord Jesus Christ, and so don't expect God to do what he did in Genesis. But here he gives dreams, and Joseph interpreted those dreams correctly, restoring, or it was going to be restoration for the cupbearer and then execution for the baker. Now, look at chapter 40, verse 13. Joseph interprets the dream for the cupbearer, and then he pleads with the cupbearer to take up his case once God has fulfilled the dream. Verse 13, this is the dream. Verse 12, he says, this is the interpretation of the three branches are 3 days. Within three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head, and he will restore you to your office, and you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. Only keep me in mind. Hey, cupbearer, remember me. When you get back to the palace, think about me, Joseph. When it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this place. He says, I don't want to be here. I don't deserve to be here. It's unjust that I'm here. And won't you please plead my case with Pharaoh so I can get out of this prison? This is Joseph's big break. It fizzled like a fireworks rocket in a rainstorm. Verse 23. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but he forgot him. So you have family love replaced by crushing family betrayal. Employers' regard and esteem replaced by his wife's bitterness and false accusations. In charge of the prison to... still in charge of the prison. Broken heart, Broken reputation, broken hopes. What is God doing? For 2 years, Joseph's hopes were lower than a snake crawling at the bottom of a trench. But the God who orders the affairs of kings and kingdoms was at work. Chapter 41, verse 1. Now it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And behold, he was standing by the Nile, and lo, from the Nile there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed in the marsh grass. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them from the Nile, and they were ugly and gaunt. And they stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile, and the ugly, gaunt, or skinny cows ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. And then Pharaoh woke up. Well, Pharaoh, obviously, when he has that kind of dream, the ancient Near East, what you did is you called in the dream interpreters. You called in the magicians. You called in the wise men and say, I had this dream. It must have been from God. What does it mean? Well, Pharaoh bought his magicians and wise men at the same shop that Nebuchadnezzar did. They're utterly worthless. Well, only once those guys have totally, failed, utterly can't explain this at all, only then does the cupbearer say, hey, I remember that young Hebrew guy who interpreted my dream when I was in jail. And Pharaoh says, hey, get him. Get him, go find him. And so they fetch Joseph from the pit, and suddenly Joseph's gone from assigning new prison ID numbers to the new guys coming in to being Pharaoh's dream interpreter, his commerce consultant, really. Verse 28 of chapter 41. Joseph gives the interpretation in the dream, and he says this to Pharaoh. He says, it is as I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he's about to do. Behold, here's the imagery. He says, 7 years of great abundance are coming on all the land of Egypt. And after them, 7 years of famine will come, and all the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the lands. Joseph says, Pharaoh, what God means by this is there's going to be a lot of prosperity for 7 years, and then there's just going to be this terrible famine. Now, famine occurred in Egypt for one of two reasons. One was too little rain, and the other was too much rain. You don't usually think of famine associated with too much rain, but it can be. Egypt, as you know, is basically a desert with a God-made irrigation ditch running through the middle of it, the Nile River. Every year, the Nile River flooded, and it fertilized the field of Egypt with new sediment, and it watered those fields because it sure didn't rain much. And so the floods on the Nile, of course, were not always the same height every year. They differed. They varied. And that depended primarily on the amount of rain in the highlands of Ethiopia, the source of the Blue Nile. The Blue Nile carries about 4 times as much water as the White Nile. And so how much it rained in Ethiopia depended on how much water got to Egypt. What the Egyptians did was this. They measured the rising of the Nile each spring, and they could tell by the height of the flood how the crops would do that year. They could predict it with stunning accuracy. If at the first cataract, the first waterfall in southern Egypt, the Nile rose 8 meters, then they would have a bumper harvest. Great crop, just everything wonderful. If, however, the flood waters rose only 6.5 meters at that first cataract, then the fields would be dry and hard by harvest time, and the crop production would be 20% below normal. If the river rose higher than usual, rose, say, to 10 meters at the first cataract, then the flood would wash away dikes, irrigation canals, whole villages, and the fields would be too wet to plant, and there would again be a 20% reduction in crop production. In other words, what Joseph is saying here is he says, Pharaoh, you're going to have 7 really good years where it's going to be 8 meters high there at the first cataract. But then you're going to have 7 years where it's going to either be very, very low floods or maybe very, very high floods. Now, Joseph has a plan, as every good administrator and organizer does. Verse 33. Now he says, let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land and let him exact 1/5 of the produce, take some taxes. The land of Egypt, in the 7 years of abundance, you take 1/5 of it and you put it away. Let him gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority and let him guard it. Don't let anybody get to it. Let the food become a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which will occur in the land of Egypt so that the land will not perish during the famine. Pharaoh's thinking, pretty good plan, right? Verse 37. Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. Now you got to figure out who's going to be the guy. Well, in the ancient Near East, which was a highly religious culture in which getting the messages from the gods was esteemed of the greatest importance, when you got a guy who could get message straight from the gods, you put him right at the top, just like Nebuchadnezzar did with Daniel. Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this?" pointing at Joseph. "Can we find a man like this in whom is the divine spirit? Are we going to find any better guy than this?" So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. And you shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne will I be greater than you." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Now that's my definition of a promotion, right? You go from jail to prime minister. Pretty good. It's obvious to Pharaoh that God is on Joseph's side, right? And so Pharaoh made him prime minister of all of Egypt at age 30. It says that over later in the text. Joseph is 30 years old, and he is now prime minister of the whole land. Proverbs 21:1 summarizes it perfectly. The king's heart, it's like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. You can hear an echo of Psalm 115, verse 3 in that, can't you? God is in the heavens and he does whatever he pleases. God is sovereign. He arranges the pieces on the chessboard exactly where he wants them. All the details of their life, the good, the bad, and the ugly of it, he puts it all together for his perfect plan. Now, when you read the story of Joseph's life, your ears pop from the elevation changes. I mean, it's just up and down and up and down. But God wasn't just playing God with Joseph's life. He's not just having fun toying around with Joseph. God's sovereignty was working out his providence. He's controlling the affairs of men to bring about his good purpose. God did it his way. And his way was, in fact, incomprehensible to Joseph. But now Joseph was in a position to bring the good that God intended. Chapter 41, verse 57. The 7 good years have passed. The 7 lean years have started. It says, "The people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the earth." Now, all the earth came to Egypt. Which part of all the earth do you think Genesis is worried about? You can figure that out, can't you? Which of the people of all the earth is Genesis concerned with? That's right, the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his 11 sons people. That's who Genesis was worried about. Chapter 42, verse 1. Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt. Jacob said to his sons, "Why are you staring at one another?" I love it. "Why are you guys sitting here looking at each other while we're starving to death? Do something." So he said, "Behold, I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us from that place so that we will live and not die." Then the 10 brothers of Joseph, Benjamin stays behind, the 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "I'm afraid that harm may befall him." Verse 6. Now Joseph was ruler over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. So Joseph's brothers came and they bowed down to him. That sounds kind of familiar. With their faces to the ground. And Joseph saw his brothers and he recognized them. But he disguised himself to them and he spoke to them harshly. And he said to them, "Where have you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." But Joseph had recognized his brothers, although they didn't recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he had had about them. Joseph remembers, it's starting to come together now, isn't it? It's starting to make sense. The incomprehensible plan of God is now starting to make sense. The next 4 chapters of Genesis are really a 3-ring circus. The first ring is Joseph's heart, his emotions. As he's meeting with his brothers, you remember, he's repeatedly rushing out of those meetings to weep uncontrollably. That's one focus. The second ring of the circus is his unwitting brothers. They don't have a clue. They have absolutely no idea what's going on. They are bewildered and confused by the accusations and actions of this Egyptian lord. They just can't figure it out.
The third ring is Jacob's home in Canaan. And the despair in Jacob's heart when he finds out that the only way to get more food and to get his son Simeon back, who was held as a hostage, the only way to get that is to send Benjamin, Joseph's younger brother, to Egypt. Something Jacob absolutely refused to do. Now, some would say that Joseph was just toying with his brothers. Just toying with him, tormenting them to get revenge for the betrayal that had happened years before. Because you remember what he does. I mean, he takes them through this whole thing. He sends them away. He puts the money back in their sack. He accuses them of being spies. He says, Simeon, your brother has to stay. I'm going to put him in jail until you bring your youngest brother back to me. That will prove to me that you're not spies. And just this whole series of things. And they go, oh, well, Joseph's just taking his revenge. It seems, however, obvious from the text that Joseph derived no evil kind of pleasure from this process. Half the time he's rushing out of the room to replenish the Nile River with his tears. Joseph's not having fun. In keeping with his noble, forgiving character, which comes out very clearly in chapters 45 and 50, it seems more likely that Joseph had a different goal besides revenge in mind. Joseph wanted this, I think, as he goes through this. He wanted his father's fear of losing Benjamin, pointed out for us already in the beginning of chapter 42. He wanted that fear of losing Benjamin. He wanted his brothers to see that in his father, so that it would bring up in their heart again the guilt of their betrayal of Joseph, which has been now about 22 years before. He wants them in that situation to be reminded, why is Dad so worried about losing Benjamin? Because Dad already lost Joseph. He wants them to feel that guilt. Not for revenge, but I think so that they would be ready to repent when he unveils himself to them. Well, the plan works as far as bringing up the guilt in the brother's heart. There's no question of that. Look at chapter 42, verse 21. They're going back and forth, and Joseph's doing these things. He says, you're spies. And they say, no, we're not spies. He says, I don't believe you. He puts him in prison for 3 days, according to verse 17. And they don't know what's going on. Verse 21, they say to one another, truly we are guilty concerning our brother. Amazing. 22 years later, these guys are still crushed with guilt over what they've done with their brother Joseph. Something goes wrong. Something goes bad. And they say, God's getting us for what we did to Joseph. Truly we are guilty concerning our brother because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us. Yet we would not listen. Therefore this distress has come upon us. Reuben answered them saying, did I not tell you? Didn't I tell you don't sin against the boy? And you wouldn't listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood. Then the irony. They didn't know, however, that Joseph understood. For there was an interpreter between them. Part of the sham that Joseph has going is he pretends he doesn't understand them. He understands them perfectly. He turned away from them and he wept. Well, the plan to produce guilt in his brother's heart worked. Joseph accused them of being spies, kept Simeon as a hostage until they would bring their youngest brother on the next trip to spring Simeon from jail. Well, you remember, they brought Benjamin along on the second trip. Dad didn't want to send him, but it's either send Benjamin or die of starvation. So in the end, Benjamin goes. They brought Benjamin, but as they were leaving, you remember, they left the city. He gave them the grain, and they had this big thing at their house, at Joseph's house. It's almost comical. He arranges the brothers in order of age, and they're thinking, how does he know this? How does he know which one of us goes, which is firstborn, which is... How does he know this? And Benjamin gets five times as much food as everyone else at the banquet. The brothers are just absolutely confused. They have no idea what's going on. And they send them out, they leave the city, and they arrest... Joseph sends some guys after, they arrest them. The money's in the throat of their sacks again, and the silver cup is in Benjamin's sack. These guys, they are just utterly befuddled. The brothers don't know what to do. Chapter 45, verse 1. Comes to the point where they are back there with Joseph. They are utterly hopeless. This guy is going to kill us all. We're never going to get back. If we do get back, Dad's going to kill us because he's not going to let Benjamin go. They're just utterly hopeless. Then Joseph, verse 1, could not control himself before. all those who stood by him. He cried out, "Have everyone go from me, leave out of the room." And he cried, "Get away. Everyone go out." So there was no man when Joseph made known himself to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it. The household of Pharaoh heard it. And then Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm Joseph. Is my father still alive?" The brothers are like, "Huh?" They're just in shock. They're dumbfounded. They couldn't answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come closer to me." And they came closer, and he said to him, "I'm your brother Joseph, that you sold into Egypt." Now, notice this. Joseph's had some time to process this since he became, Pharaoh's prime minister. He's starting to understand what God's doing. He says, verse 5, "Now don't be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." God does what he wants, and he gets other people to do what he wants too, and it all works as part of his plan. "God sent me here," says Joseph. He's sovereign. He's the one that arranges it. He puts the pieces on the chessboard. "For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance." Through all the ups and downs of Joseph's life, God moved him towards a specific target. Until this point, it had been completely incomprehensible to Joseph. From the day that his brothers had thrown him down in that pit and sold him like a trinket to those traitors, Joseph had found God's plan impenetrable. Now, 22 years later, he understands. God had sovereignly directed all those vicissitudes, all those ups and downs. The evil jealousy of his brothers, the frustrated temper tantrum of Potiphar's wife, the forgetfulness of the cupbearer, all the evil and unfairness of men even, was used by God to bring a perfect result. "God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth." Do you remember how Burkhoff, the theologian, said it? "He preserves all his creatures, is operative in all that comes to pass, and he directs all things to their appointed end." 17 years after this, when Joseph revealed himself to his brothers, he had to explain it all to his brothers again. You see, they were sure now, Jacob died 17 years after this. They were sure now that Dad was out of the way, Joseph would exact his revenge. Certainly he could. He's the second most powerful guy in Egypt. He can pretty much do what he wants. Joseph in chapter 50 says, "Guys, you just don't understand." Chapter 50, verse 15. It says, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we've did to him?' So they sent a message to Joseph saying, 'Your father charged before he died.'" He didn't. They were putting a lie, this lie in Jacob's mouth. "So your father said before he died, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father,' say the brothers." Joseph wept when he spoke to them. They didn't understand forgiveness. He says, "Guys, I forgave you. It's done. It's over. That's it. I'm not going to bring that back up." Joseph wept in sorrow that they had been living in this fear for another 17 years. "And then his brothers also came and they fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are servants.' Joseph said to them, 'Don't be afraid. For am I in God's place?'" He says, "Am I God that I'm going to execute you? I mean, if God wants to take vengeance, he'll take vengeance. It's not my job." He says, "Don't be afraid. I'm not in God's place." Now notice verse 20. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive." You meant it evil, but God, as he arranged all the pieces on the chessboard, he meant it for good. The account of Joseph is what God's sovereignty looks like in the action or inaction in the life of a person like you and me. It's not God's sovereignty in some grand cosmic realm. It's not God's sovereignty in the international realm, even though a little bit of that comes in. It's God's sovereignty in the life of someone like you and me. What is to us inexplicable is to Him just the next step in His plan to bring His perfectly good result. Could there be any better picture in the Bible of God's sovereignty and providence than Joseph? God is sovereign over events. He is sovereign over evil. He is sovereign over famines, pharaohs, and rainfall in Ethiopia. Men do their worst. God, in His impenetrable wisdom and utter sovereignty, orchestrates that sin, that discord, and that cacophony into a symphony of beauty and good. Like Joseph, you have ups and downs in your life too. Apparently inexplicable things happen. Men do their worst. Circumstances pile in. Don't forget that when it appears to you and to Joseph, when it appears that it's just mindless chaos, that is in fact the perfect plan of the God who orders every event to happen just the way He wants it to. Now, let's go back to where we started this evening. Theology matters. Theology matters. You live out what you believe about God. And what the Bible teaches about God is sovereign. The story of Joseph is what that sovereignty looks like in everyday life. Disaster for us is for him the next step towards good. Joseph's life was a roller coaster of ups and downs, but God had laid the tracks. And Joseph didn't go flying off them. And you won't either. When life is inexplicable, and it will be at times, then remember Joseph. And call to mind what God is like. God is sovereign. Not just in a universal cosmic sense, but He is sovereign over every event in our lives. He can do anything He wants, and He can do that in your life. And in fact, He does. But be assured that what God is doing will always bring His good and perfect result. That's God's sovereignty. And it matters because it allows us to trust Him even in the darkest, most desperate of times. Let's pray. Lord, You bring unanticipated good. You did it in the life of Joseph. You do it in our lives as well. It's Your sovereignty. It's Your providence working all these things together. Joseph thrown in the pit at just the right time, not finding his brothers before that because they had moved locations. And then he's thrown in the pit, and then just the right traders are going by so that they can sell him to Potiphar's house as a slave. And just every little step of the way, we look at it and we see that You ordered it all. You ordered every single thing. And what You did for Joseph, You do for us. We may not rise to the heights that Joseph did, and that's fine. But You also order our lives. Lord, how that helps us to trust You. How it helps us to see that You are in control, that You are in charge, and You will do what Romans 8:28 says. You will work all things together for good for those who love You. Lord, when difficult times come this week, this month, this year, when we face challenges, I pray that as a congregation, we would think back to Joseph, and we would remember that You do Your good. You do it sovereignly. You do it providentially. You work out every circumstance just the way it should be because it's Your perfect plan. Lord, help us to trust You, knowing that You love us. You are a good shepherd. You are our sovereign God. We do trust You. In Jesus' name we give You thanks. Amen.